Coal mining, for instance, had little to do with the empire and the world, at least in the medium term. Even if we look at British or French history...
Right, we're here in Cambridge. We're in St. John's College. My name is Elisa Rublack, and I want to start this event, which is entitled Writing World History, with my thank yous. I want to say thank you to all of you for coming. I want to say thank you to the Center for History and Economics for supporting this event. Thank you to the Trevelyan Fund managers for supporting this event in my own college, and to Laura Cousins from the History Faculty. Above all, however, you need to listen to this, too. Mary Rose Cheadle from the Center for History and Economics for all her secretarial and administrative support, which has been terrific. Thank you very, very much. There are two reasons for having this event. The most immediate reason for it is that we have now two masterpieces of multi-centric world history writing for the modern period: Chris Bailey's Birth of the Modern World and Jung Osterhammel's more recent book, Die Transformation, Transformation of the World. Sorry, I got confused with the German and English, which is currently being translated in its 1,800 pages by Princeton University Press. And this book was written in dialogue, in part, with Chris Bailey's work, and I want to get that dialogue out of the scholarly study and into our environment, because I think it will help us to stimulate the debates about what is currently one of the most complex methodological challenges history faces. How do we do this? How do we write world history? The second reason for it is, and for my own engagement with these questions, is that I was asked several years ago to edit a concise companion to history for Oxford University Press. And when one is asked to edit a book of this kind, and two of the contributors sit here, Chris Bailey and Chris Clark, one, of course, does not want to make this a concise companion to Western history. The result of our endeavors to think across themes such as power, the emotions, gender, and the force of ideas in multicentric ways will be published next spring. So I very much hope that we can continue the conversations, which we're going to start in this very compact way today at a similar event around the Concise Companion to History next spring. Without further ado, I want to introduce, first of all, Professor Richard Evans, our Regius Professor, who would like to welcome and introduce this event on behalf of the History Faculty, Cambridge.
Right, well, thank you very much. And I think I'd like to add our thanks and that of the History Faculty to Olinka Rublack for organizing this event. I think it's a tremendously enterprising. thing to do. I suppose I'm here in several different capacities. One is as chairman of the History Faculty. One is as the chairman of the managers of the Trevelyan Fund, which is supporting this, and I think G.M. Trevelyan would certainly have approved of this kind of event, since his interests are much more broad and much more global than many people, I think, would realize today. Another is that I'm writing, or supposed to be writing, the Penguin History of 19th Century Europe from 1815 to 1914, though being chairman of the History Faculty has got seriously in the way of doing that, and I haven't written a word since last September, but I will finish this. And one of the things that you, but one of the things that you confront somebody writing a book like that is, of course, the global turn which historians have taken in the last few years. And that, of course, directs me towards thinking about the place of Europe in the wider world. And that gives a kind of unity to the period, a period in which Europe became the leading, for a time, became the leading continent in the world and started to dominate other parts of the world. But also, I think it's interesting to look back and realize that world history, the global turn, globalization, all of which things go together, is not a wholly recent development. Some of you may have read William H. McNeill's The Rise of the West, which is, I think, still the leading history of the world from the very beginnings to the present. presence. And interestingly, 25 years after he'd published it in the 60s, MacNeill, who only ever wrote global histories of disease, of military matters, and so on, and directed the insights of global history towards more precise subjects, I think, in an extremely fruitful way. But 25 years after he'd written it, he came back and rethought his The Rise of the West. And in a remarkable piece of self-criticism, he singled out, first of all, its Eurocentrism, and said, were he writing it at that point, 25 years later, he would not call it The Rise of the West, it might be something different. And I think that points to our two authors, two main speakers today, who both, of course, work on other parts of the world, China and India, in their main empirical interest, research interest, and are not European historians in any kind of narrow sense, or global historians in a wide sense. And then MacNeill also regretted that he bound his book together by looking at different civilizations, as he called them, and comparing them, and not really paying enough attention to the interconnections between them, or the things that they had in common. That, for me, I think is one of the main interests of these of the two books by Westphalen and Jürgen Osterhammel, that they do in fact do this. They look at all the interconnections, commonalities, as well as compare. They are very different books. I have read every word of this one. I can't claim to have read every word of this one, but I've read quite a bit of it. And they are very different in style and approach. And I think that points up partly to national differences in historical style, the way in which they present their work. I was once reviewed a book by the great Thomas Nipperdey, The History of Germany in the 19th Century, for the Times Literary Supplement, which sparked a leader in the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, because I complained there were some jokes in it. And I think there's a way in which the German style of historical writing, as Jürgen Osterhammel says in his self-critique that you will have read, that does give you the voice of the professor, as it were, presenting ideas, presenting interpretations, putting forward views as to how one studies subject. And there's a danger there, I think, that the voice of the past gets a little bit submerged. But I'm already going into the subjects of the discussion. So the last thing I'd like to say is that Cambridge has been successful in getting a grant from the German Academic Exchange Service for a series of seminars jointly with the University of Constance and Freiburg University and the Free University of Berlin to hold both here and in Germany on the subject of Germany and the world in the age of globalization. Those start in 2011, so it's particularly good that we're having this particular meeting here, and that may well as well get that off to the start as well. So that's really all I've got to say. I hope this is going to be a very interesting morning, and over to you.
I'd like to welcome then very much Jürgen Osterhammel for coming to this event despite the British Airways strike and having made this trip. He's just received last week the Leibniz Prize, which is the most prestigious prize in Germany for his work, which of course encompasses many volumes on the history of China from the 18th to the 20th century, and has culminated in this new approach he's presenting here. Thank you very much for coming.
Yes, thank you very much. I have to apologize at the outset for reading a paper of about 30 minutes. Having been away from this country for quite a long time, my English is too shaky for a more lively presentation. This is a great and exciting event for me, and I'm first of all most grateful for the invitation that brought me here. In a sense, it is a voyage in, a visit from a small and young provincial university in Germany's deep south to one of the major centers of learning. It is world history that brings us together, not German history, which is probably the most frequent reason for German historians to be invited abroad. We are meeting on some kind of extraterritorial ground outside the usual highway of Anglo-German exchange and collaboration. This encounter in a third realm is highlighted by the fact that I do not, and this is now in flat contradistinction to what Professor Evans has just been saying, that I do not consider my work to be German in any meaningful sense. I was not raised inside the tightly knit world of the German Zunft, the Guild of Historians. I never had an academic job before the age of 30, and I spent the subsequent 28 years to lobby with very limited success for what in Germany is called non-European history or extra-European history, a marginal field at the periphery of the profession. I never obtained the desired position for modern Chinese history, and when I was finally offered one, I had forgotten most of my Chinese. So now I'm mostly teach European. Well, this is a bitter fate, but a European history within a wider context. Perhaps it was naturally for me to drift towards world history at a time when the great boom of world and global history was not yet to be anticipated. I had studied both China and the British Empire, two historical formations of more than parochial significance. I had come under the influence of Professor Wolfgang Mommsen, the historian of imperialism and superb student of Max Weber's work, and also of Professor Ernst Schulin at the University of Freiburg, whose knowledge of the history of European Weltgeschichtsschreibung, the historiography of world history, is unsurpassed. Finally, I received much personal encouragement from a number of senior historians with an interest in more than just European history, of whom I only mentioned Dietmar Rotermund, Jürgen Kocker, Henk Wesseling, Peter Marshall, Ian Nish, and the late Ronald Robinson. The reason why I'm going into these petty biographical details is simply to illustrate to what extent a commitment to world history, at least in my generation, depended on contingent constellations rather than on well-established career patterns. Today is the first time since perhaps the late Enlightenment that it is possible to call oneself a world historian without provoking disdain and ridicule. It would be difficult to explain why I was foolhardy enough to throw myself into a huge project on the 19th century without invitation from a serious editor and with no prompting by a publisher. One of the reasons was that all sorts of people in Germany started to talk about what world history ought to look like, while none of these bright theorists ever thought of undertaking the menial work of actually writing in that particular mode. Someone should, and this was my original impulse, narrow the gap between theory and practice. The top heaviness of the German discourse on world history is incidentally one of the reasons why I'm a bit reluctant to reflect on my own work in an explicitly theoretical manner. Why the 19th century? A long one, beginning in the last quarter of the 18th century and extended in some respects beyond the First World War. Why not the 18th or the 20th century, the foci of my earlier books? Because the 19th century was the first time in history when contact across vast spaces became sustained, relevant in quantitative terms, and crystallized in fairly stable institutions. Think of the patterns of mass migration, of agrarian frontier development, of the gold standard, or of the new kind of defensive semi-Westernization that changed the nature of Japanese society and left deep marks in other parts of the world. Compared to the 18th century, the 19th achieved a decisively higher level of global integration. Put alongside the 20th, especially its second half, it enables us to study many societies in a condition where traditional social and cultural fabrics were not entirely eroded by full-scale globalization. In that sense, it is certainly highly appropriate to speak of the birth of the modern world, but it was a very long, drawn-out process that stretches the metaphor of birth to its very limits, unless big history makes a century shrink to the flapping of a butterfly's wings. As I have indicated in my pre-circulated paper, which some of you might know, I don't know to what extent it was...
No.
I cannot sort of take it to be read. Okay. I've indicated in that paper that my own book, for which I may perhaps sometimes use the acronym VW and BMW, if I'm allowed to, for the other book. It was, yes, it's much superior.
Not German enough.
If I had the choice between the two, okay. I must say, I drive Toyota, so it's a question. So VW was not intended to be an anti-Bailey. I drew up the basic plan early in 2002 and started writing immediately. After the publication of BMW, I dropped the project severely shell-shocked. Apart from the sheer brilliance of Bailey's book, it seemed to me that Bailey and I were too close in terms of our fundamental historiographical outlook to warrant yet another book. Bailey had superbly mastered at least two of what I consider to be major challenges to any historian. First, how to write a book that is theory conscious to a very high degree while not allowing theory to overwhelm a narrative appeal to the ordinary reader. And second, how to steer an independent middle course between valuable elements of tradition and the inspiration offered by post-colonialism and post-modernism. Anyway, I resumed writing after a long interval, a very long interval, and when I started again, I kept my copy of BMW unopened on the shelf in order to avoid imitation and renewed traumatization. Therefore, my book is neither a challenge nor a response to BMW, but an independent alternative based on a similar approach to historiography, while guided by a different set of thematic preferences and aimed at a German reading public that is unused to any kind of imperial history and only mildly interested in anything going on outside Europe. BMW enjoyed the benefits of priority. It set an impossibly demanding precedence and devalued much of what the later author had intended to say. For example, I was delighted to read BMW's highly innovative chapter on the destruction of native peoples and ecological depredation, and at the same time shattered by my great colleague's prior insight. What Bailey had dealt with superbly needed no repeating. Thus, when I do not mention bodily practices, that does not mean that I disagree. Just the opposite. It is a seminal idea, but a BMW trademark concept to which I cannot add anything. On a different level, there are some standard topics where BMW cannot be improved upon, in particular ethnicity and nationalism, on which I'm certainly too brief, and, for example, religion. The most striking feature shared by the two books is their ambition. They both claim to be state-of-the-art historiography to be judged by the highest current standards of historical writing. This is an important point to make given the strong and perhaps growing tendency of world history literature to be brief, simplified, and didacticized. Having recently escaped from the straitjacket of multi-volume compilations for popular consumption, world history is rapidly falling back into its old ways of vulgarisation. In Germany, two series of volumes have started to be published, and there are more to come, where regional specialists contribute conventional area chapters loosely held together by that new global idiom in which such texts come to be written, the language of flows and networks, entanglements and identities, suggesting analytical depth while in fact sometimes bordering on the trivial. In the Anglophone market, the now emerging New Oxford World History, a series of single-authored books of less than 200 pages, is too recent for a responsible assessment. Yet, the one volume I've read carefully, written by a distinguished historian from California, stitches together colorful set pieces while affording only glimpses of what Bailey and I consider the essence of world historical writing, comparisons, and the careful examination of connections. There may be a danger that the curricular agenda and the commercial attractions of standardized textbook writing inhibit the search for new and experimental possibilities of analysis and literary presentation. In what follows, I will spoil the game by not joining the tournament with Sir Christopher. nor am I going to offer a comparison of our books. That is a reviewer's task and requires the uninvolved distance of the detached reader. A few critical and self-critical remarks may be found in the pre-circulated paper. Before we turn to problems of writing history, we should, however, take note of the fact that we are facing challenges in three different fields. Obviously, writing, but also teaching and research. The three are closely related. The main problem of teaching world history is how to avoid the impression that it is simple and easy, a continuous string of outsized events from the Big Bang to 9/11 and global warming. Many textbooks, especially those for US college use, tend to create a closed worldview of neatly ordered globality. Thus, they fail to insist on a crucial point. The more general, selective, and macro a specific approach to history is, the more constructed, hypothetical, and problem-orientated it has to be. This should be conveyed in teaching. Moreover, teaching has to help students run through the entire scale of levels of analysis, from the careful examination of a single source upwards to the art of framing a general problem in a global way. This leads immediately to the writing of world history. What kind of textbooks do we need? Do books like BMW and VW, though not tailored to pedagogical needs, work in classroom teaching? How do we introduce a sense of complexity and puzzlement without agnosticism and the abandonment of structural thinking? Are there open forms avoiding the banal positivism that always threatens the good name of world history writing? Teaching and writing both ultimately depend on research. The much maligned old world history was often quite remote from the concerns of working historians, and sometimes it was written by people who had never seen a source in their life. We are now past that stage, but it still bears repeating that world history will only establish itself firmly if it finds ways to develop viable research perspectives. Questions like the following ones have to be asked. What does research mean in terms of world history? How are topics to be generated? How are young scholars to be trained, enabling them to tackle transnational and transcultural research projects on a PhD or postdoc level? What are the standards for judging the quality of research? In other words, what is good world history writing? How can research best be organized within a wider multidisciplinary environment as part of global studies, or rather in joint programs or graduate schools, a German specialty, bringing together general, which means presumably European, historians with a regional specialization, sociologists, anthropologists, and so on. When we think of writing world history, we are likely to have two different yet related things in mind: writing a research monograph or writing a synthesis. The monograph makes high demands on the presumably inexperienced researcher. The subject matter is more dispersed across space and time than in the case of most other historical writing, and therefore more difficult to integrate into a coherent whole. In my experience, advising PhD students who work on global topics requires an unusually close attention to issues of structure and composition. But we are today less concerned with research monographs than with the production of surveys on a grander scale, in other words, with syntheses. That term is a little misleading, since what is meant is essentially a bunch of analyses devoted to a particular period or to a comprehensive issue. This is not the proper place to go deeply into the intriguing problem of historical synthesis in general. Therefore, just a few observations. I do not really consider my own book to be a work of synthesis. It does not summarize scholarship in an even-handed way, nor is it a quite different meaning of the slippery term synthesis, an attempt to uncover the essence of a given historical age. My kind of world history does not stand in relation to regional histories which resembles that of brandy to wine. Or, using a different metaphor, a synthesis is not a juice squeezer mechanically extracting from specialized research its most valuable substance. It is rather, dare I utter the risky word, a carefully constructed work of art. The auctorial voice, absolutely indispensable to this kind of writing, bundles and coordinates a large number of analyses. It is a networking voice. It organizes comparisons and other kinds of mental experiments. It also devises fragile hierarchies of generality, takes charge of the famous jeu d'échelle. However, the reader has a right to be treated gently. If he or she cares about levels of analysis, it should be possible to distinguish clearly between them. If not, the text should flow all the same. What is intended by the author as a tapestry of analyses may be perceived as a synthesis by the reader. Synthesis, this would be my suggestion, lies in the eye of the beholder. She or he performs the cognitive act of synthesizing. A book supports several different readings and different ways of apprehension. The one privileged by the author need not necessarily be the version preferred by the reader. The question which qualities lead us to admire certain works of synthesis in comparison to others can be applied, of course, to any field of history. Why are Christopher Clark or Richard Evans superior to their rivals? Probably because they are Cambridge people. There may be other answers. By what criteria do we identify a satisfying, perhaps even a masterly synthesis when we see it? There are quite a few accomplished practitioners of that genre in this room, so I leave the debate open and proceed to another question. What distinguishes methodologically and practically, a comprehensive narrative of one particular national history from a European one, and this in turn from a global analysis? A synthesis, I'm sorry. Instead of offering a solution to that problem, I would like to add a few more, to be precise, 11 questions. They come under the heading of choices, since they do not refer to theory alone, but concern the craft of writing world just as other history. The somewhat deliberate order, so I'm jumping between these points, is due to the untidy nature of my pre-circulated paper, but for those who have it, I think it's helpful that I stick to the order I had decided upon in writing that paper. Now, first, how do we arrive at spatial units and territorial frameworks? My advice to the budding world historian would be, first, do some meta-geography, take a step backwards from conventional geographical terminology, look for the nomenclature used by the historical subjects in your chosen epoch, and above all, deconstruct and perhaps discard the notion of the West. Then take on board a bit of recent work on territorialization and deterritorialization, and read a couple of good books and articles on concepts such as boundary, border, and frontier. Always consider things in terms of regions rather than of today's nation states, and think twice before you speak generally and grandiosely of Europe, Africa, or America. If you think that those words denote not just spaces, but whole civilizations, try to define those civilizations by looking not at their centers, but at the peripheries where they meet their neighbors. Second, world history should not be a history just of big events, big processes, big people, but to what extent and how do we integrate the marginal? Historical scholarship has made huge progress in looking at the excluded and the underprivileged, the outsiders and the losers. Offers a broad range of eccentric angles. The distinction between centers and peripheries retains its usefulness, but has to be handled with utmost flexibility. Almost anything can become a periphery within shifting asymmetrical relationships. As for practical advice, get into the distancing habit by reading Julian Barnes' delightful History of the World in 10 and a half chapters. Published in 1989, especially chapter 1, The History of Noah's Ark from the Perspective of a Woodworm. Consider the general proposition that innovation occurs as often at the margins as at centers. In choosing illustrative examples, look for unknown and surprising cases. Third, how much theoretical diversity are we willing to tolerate? World history has to be eclectic in its choice and of theoretical guidance. Wherever helpful, it will draw on sociology, anthropology, economics, political science, the comparative study of religions, and so on. Eclecticism should not be carried to the point of obvious inconsistencies between the theories you choose. Not anything goes. At the other extreme, beware of mega theories that seem to explain everything. For example, world system theory if handled without the necessary circumspection. The most helpful theories may be those related to specific and medium-range fields. Industrialization and the Industrial Revolution, demographic evolution, agrarian change, peasant protest, empires and imperialism, religious secularization, and so on. Aim at a richly polychromatic analysis that will support a readable book. Make it readable by hiding your theoretical machinery behind the curtain of narrative. Keep the concept generator gently humming in the background. And don't be too faithful to your theories. We as historians should have a first-hand knowledge of them, but we are not obliged to interpret them lege artis. When sociologists use our books as quarries, we reciprocate by treating their theorists in exactly the same way. One additional remark, we should not overlook the self-description and self-reflection of past ages, or even more broadly, their social and cultural semantics. And I think this is one of the most important fields for research in the future. Now, point number four. How do we order and categorize a myriad of experiences and identities? How can individual voices become audible? Problem raised already by Professor Evans. The old device of world historians and macro sociologists to generalize across so-called civilizations will no longer do. Samuel Huntington dealt the death blow to this comfortable habit, although there still is a sophisticated theory of civilization in the work of the later S.N. Eisenstadt. A useful unit of analysis and narration on a level below macro entities like the empire, the nation state, is the community, defined as a fairly stable macro group with shared memories, experiences, and often rules of access and exit. A related unit is that of the milieu. World history in a synthesizing register cannot be assembled just inductively from the bottom up as an aggregate. The level of the individual human life is probably outside its systematic purview. But it needs, and this is a main reason why world history books cannot always be brief, coloring through the biographical dimension, something largely missing due to lack of space from my own Verwandlung der Welt. World historians should read as many ego documents and memoirs as possible, among them especially those produced by and referring to historical nobodies. A huge number of sources of this kind are probably left to be discovered and in many cases translated, and for recent times oral history still has a role to play. Fifth, various aspects of history differ in their affinity to generalization. The world economy or the international system lend themselves better to modeling than world society or world culture. In particular, how is it possible to come up with globally valid assumptions about culture? I simply do not know, and I have never seen a truly satisfying global history of culture that captures enough diversity. Perhaps a suitable way for a global history of culture lies in stressing flows and transfers at the expense of comparisons. Religious history, for example, is no longer merely conceived of as a juxtaposition of a handful of so-called world religions, but as a history of adaptations, conversions, and syncretisms, a view that should not, however, be dogmatically overstated. There are limits to the hybridization of religious beliefs and practices, of languages, kinship rules, or systems of law. Sixth, should world historians make use of typologies, types of societies, of economic systems, of religions, and so on? Yes, they are an indispensable tool if employed without schematism and pedantry. Typologies help to clarify concepts. We can only define For example, empire by situating the term within a matrix of various types of polities. Typologies, rarely seen as closed and all-encompassing ones, help to bridge inter-civilizational divides by alerting us to the possibility that basic forms of social organization, for example, capitalism, monasticism, or the nuclear family, can materialize within vastly different cultural contexts. Seventh, do we still believe in the romantic and historicist notion of the unity of an age, or even a zeitgeist, the spirit of an age? Do we really need it for constructing acceptable temporal units of analysis? To some extent, yes, but on a global scale, probably not before the mid-19th century. With good reason, historians tend to be suspicious of mystifications of that kind. They are wary of neat models of stages of human evolution, although such stages make sense in certain arguments of social theory. Avoid, and this is my advice, the word pre-modern, and think of the simultaneity of the non-simultaneous. Do not forget that cultural and political struggles have been fought over the character of a particular age. Examples would be the European Reformation or Europe between the world wars. Question number 8, are canons of subjects still plausible, or are they perhaps even indispensable? They are indeed hard to avoid. Revisionist histories propose their own counter-canons. Then Shaka, the Zulu king, is as important as Bismarck. Why not for the sake of the argument? Still, the fundamental proportions and the allotment of significance must not violate the empirical evidence. A world history of the 19th century without Shaka would be inadequate, one without Bismarck grotesque. Historiography, if you permit me a tasteless pun, is an artillery battle, a struggle of cannon makers. This extends to problems of writing technique. Just as a dramatist or novelist starts by drawing up a list of dramatis personae, one has to decide what to include and what to leave out. Reviewers will check the index. A radio journalist complained to me on a program that I had neglected Zanzibar. And of course he was right, given his specific and personal interest in East Africa. And a reader who introduced herself as a retired headmistress wrote to me pointing out that I had mentioned Tolstoy, but not Dostoevsky. Chris Bailey, of course, has them both, but not Balzac and not Verdi. In any case, don't overdo your advance planning, but do not leave your priorities to chance and intuition. I skip number 9 in the internal paper because it's already been hinted at. Number 10 is the following question. In national history, grand narratives often serve the purpose of collective identity formation. Even today, they are sometimes composed with that specific aim in mind. My great colleague Heinrich August Winkler is one who stands for this attitude to history. Does this also apply to world history? This is not a question world historians are apt to put to themselves. Others seem to be worried, so we need an answer. It never occurred to me that I should frame anyone's identity, least of all that of my fellow historians. Perhaps this derives from the experience of never having worked from within a community of discourse. A German historian of writing on China simply does not shape Chinese identity. If we accept the implication of the question, namely that history is not content with just entertaining and enlightening individuals, it is perhaps not unreasonable to ask whether we aim at creating supranational cosmopolitan personalities with new ideas about global responsibility. In other words, do world historians educate citizens of the world? Do they have to subscribe to a worldview of globalism, preferably one with the optimistic pieties of a globalized Whig interpretation left out, that is, the conviction that anything promoting mobility, exchange, and network building, except for such spectacular horrors as the slave and opium trades, is good, while nationalism, insistence on local forms of culture, and so on, are subject to censure? 11th and final question. How much explanation do we wish to achieve? Which models of causation are the most adequate? How do determinism and contingency relate to one another? Explanations in world history are typically huge ones, for instance, looking for the causes of the divergence of developmental paths. One particular type of world history focuses almost exclusively on this sort of explanation. It yields complex intellectual puzzles based on comparative reasoning rather than narratives in the usual sense. This kind of world history, perfectly legitimate, concentrates, as it must for methodological reasons, on a very small number of cases at the expense of the rest of the world. The most important example, of course, is the perennial debate about the rise of the West, Europe's special path in modern history, and so on. Chris Bailey's book, in contrast to my own one, takes a stand in that debate. At the same time, both books prefer what might be called embedded explanations, fitted into the larger context of the descriptive stories being told. A major challenge of this kind of panoramatic writing is the explanation of similar and synchronic occurrences in different parts of the world. For example, the chronological coincidence of political turbulence in Europe, North America, China, India, and Japan between 1848 and 1868, or the worldwide crisis of the 17th century, investigated in a systematic way by Jack Goldstone, who regards demographic change as the independent variable in his model of comparative explanation. A different kind of problem, of causal problem, is this: do we improve on conventional explanations of major events if we place them within wider horizons? Examples are the possible African and Caribbean factors behind early industrialization in England, the American causes of the French Revolution, and so on. A radical reply to that question would be to say that almost any historical problem stands to gain from being reframed in a global perspective. I'm not so sure. But accepting and propagating this claim looks like a clever move. It would multiply the employment chances of world historians. On the whole, I take a thoroughly pluralist view of the future of world history writing. There is no superior recipe for success. World history is a new tendency with an old pedigree. Few among us aspire to be full-time world historians. We know how important it is to keep in touch with research. As far as we are world historians, we pursue two aims at the same time: to make world a global history respected in the profession and to raise critical awareness in the public at large. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for this stimulating presentation. Before handing over to Chris Bailey, I would just like to say that my secret guest of honor today is Professor Jack Goody. Jack, I would just like to pay tribute to all your work. Your last book on the Renaissances in a multi-centric way just came out, and you're publishing every year in a way that puts us all to shame. And you've done so much to earn respectability for the perspectives just outlined here. You can think the world and throughout history, and I would like you to join me in thanking and welcoming Jack Goody. Over to Chris Bailey, Professor of Imperial and Naval History, I noticed at the University of Cambridge, and author of BMW.
Thank you. Well, Naval is flying under false colours, but thank you very much. And thank you particularly for organising this event, Mr. Linker. I'm glad that we have discarded our honorific names, that you've discarded your academic gown, and I've discarded my doublet and hose. So from now on, I'm Chris and you're Jürgen. Yes? I want to say that, first of all, in his original response, Jürgen said that this shouldn't be a contest. And I quite agree with that. I think he has very well sketched out the differences and similarities between our books. But I think even if it was a contest, the referee would have stopped it before the first blow had been cut. Because there's a big difference between my book, which is a welterweight of under 500 pages, and his heavyweight of 1,500 pages. Also, I can order a beer in Berlin, but that's about it. However, I have read a lot of his very interesting articles in English on Far Eastern history in particular, and I think that it is, even though he says that he is less known in the German Academy, he's certainly very well known in the English, American, and other English-speaking academies. So I'll begin briefly by discussing some of the important methodological issues opened up in Jürgen's paper, and then move on to some actual development in 19th century history, which might help us define some of the problems that face world history writing. First, the academic context for world history in Britain differs from what Jürgen describes in Germany, primarily because of the persistence of British imperial history here. Imperial history has been both a boon and an impediment for the development of world history. Even in Cambridge, which has a much better record in this area than Oxford and many other UK history departments, China and the Middle East have traditionally been hived off into Oriental faculties. This means that even today, the world, for us, tends to be coterminous with the old British Empire, or at least its dependent non-white colonies, with an occasional foray into the French Empire. Though we have been lucky in this university that Richard Evans has fostered students working on the wider German world. On the other side, imperial history, if done well, does remind us of the importance of power, force, exploitation, war, and invasion in world history. This is something that world histories of connection and comparison, or more recently of cosmopolitanism, sometimes elide. Another thing propelling world history forward, but again with ambivalent results, has been the massive gravitational force exerted by the American Academy here in the UK. Diaspora and multiculturalism in the US has transformed Western Civ Course 101 into World History 101. British historians working in the US have begun to market themselves as world historians, not always to good effect, but this has had a knock-on effect in Britain. Jürgen has given us an expert summary of the problems and opportunities inherent in world history. What I want to stress is that for me, world history is a sensibility, not really a subject. World history is not a style of book, let alone a complete map. One can't do everything. I'm sorry that neither of us has done Latin America justice, but then we do have people such as Josep Pradera in Barcelona, who's taken a resolutely Latin and Latin American position on world history to great effect. Equally, though, world history is not a single methodology. Jürgen tells us that he's partly a latter-day Weberian. Eric Hobsbawm, in whose shadow I certainly write world history, is a latter-day Marxist. I suppose, personally, I try to marry some Marxism attitudes with an approach one might call chaotic conjunctural modernization. At any rate, no one can propose a single methodology, space, or even temporal structure for world history. It's a way of thinking about history contextually, and I'll argue that it's also a dialectical form of historical sensibility. I think it was Edward Gibbon who said that history was philosophy teaching by example. I would say that historiography should be history teaching by example. So I want to move on from abstract issues to some examples of the sensibility of world history in practice and the methodological problems it throws up. So I'm not apologizing for moving from historiographical problems, such as Jürgen has outlined, to actual historical examples, because only the latter can throw light on the former. For obvious reasons, I'll discuss cases I know, some of them taken from the work of staff and students in our own world history group, which is very well represented in this audience. But my impression is that similar and related work is going on in many universities around the world, particularly in the USA. Jürgen and I have both been concerned initially with the 19th century, and some of the most interesting work in recent months has concerned the Revolutionary Age and its aftermath at a world level. The aim has been to develop the notion of comparison connection, but without erasing the anomalous, the narratives that don't fit into global or even trans-regional patterns. In December, David Armitage and Sanjay Subramaniam published The Age of Revolutions in Global Context, 1760 to 1840. This included, for instance, an essay by Lynn Hunt on the French Revolution and by Juan Cole on Bonaparte's army in the Orient. Later this year, a related joint volume edited by Jane Rendell and John McClelland War, Empire, and Slavery will appear covering a similar period and a slightly later period, but also reaching to Russia. Simon Schaffer, Lisa Roberts, Kapil Raj, Jane Sobulgo have also just published The Brokered World, Go-Betweens in Global Intelligence, 1770 to 1820. This is ostensibly a world history of science, but in fact, it goes much wider. A fourth related work is Maurizio Isabella's Risorgimento in Exile, which was discussed at the Institute of Historical Research yesterday evening. This concerns liberal Italian exiles in Spain, Greece, Britain, and South America, and argues that the Risorgimento both contributed to and drew on radical liberalism across the world between the 1820s and 1850s. Isabella develops the idea of a liberal international, bringing together the European, North Atlantic, and South Atlantic worlds. I'd extend this to Asia, especially Goa, Bengal, Batavia, and the Philippines. These were links of affect and thought created by global diasporas of merchants and political exiles, powerfully inflected by the massive expansion of the press worldwide. When one thinks of the press, this was a preeminent motor of globalization, especially since 1750. In giving a broad overview of the Age of Revolutions in the extra-European world, all these monographs and collections have attempted to highlight a number of issues which should concern both research and teaching in world history. First, they've tried to balance the notion of an Atlantic space of revolution, embracing America, France, Ireland, the Caribbean, and Latin America, with a Middle Eastern one stretching broadly from Alexandria through Goa, Calcutta, and Batavia to Manila. Recent studies of the Latin American revolutions have tended to downplay long-term social and economic preconditions for the collapse of the Iberian empires, emphasizing instead the consequence of Napoleon's invasion of the peninsula. In the Asian revolutionary space, like the Caribbean, protracted European contests for naval and commercial power and conflicts over issues of race provided a clear long-term precondition for the revolutionary storm. In addition, Asian powers seeking to protect themselves against European encroachment tried to benefit from the consequences of the collapse of imperial authority during these revolutions. The causation here, and causation is a vital issue of world historical writing, as Jürgen has explained it, was multicentric, though the European explosion was at the core. The medium-term results of the European revolutions in both spheres were largely conservative. The Spanish, Portuguese, and Dutch empires survived, and the British Asian Empire expanded following the Revolutionary Wars. The racial hierarchy was not significantly shaken. Creole elites gained greater power in Latin America, Goa, and the Philippines. But faced with powerful European and Asian competitors, colonial authority persisted in the East, in contrast to the situation in Latin America. Nevertheless, the period did see the emergence of a tradition of radical, liberal, or cosmopolitan politics in many Asian and Atlantic port cities. Demands for constitutional representation, freedom of the press, and racial equality in employment were empowered by themes taken from revolutionary discourses in Europe and America. The first generation of Asian, African, and Middle Eastern liberals blended these Euro-American ideological appropriations with themes taken from their own traditions. Hindu notions of freedom, mukti, Islamic ideas of the original consultative body of Islam, the shura, and aspects of African religion. In Christianized parts of the Iberian Empire, old ideas of spiritual equality, or the virtue of old religious and spiritual immunities, were blended with radical ideas to empower liberal traditions. Histories of the progress of Asian civilizations began to be written, legitimizing these calls for liberty and representation. What resulted was a political and ideological compromise. Over much of the Asian and even African world, as in Europe, the theory of mixed constitutions, monarchies with an element of popular participation, proved a serviceable ideological tool with which to build a functioning civil society. There began a limited recruitment of non-whites into institutions such as the jury or minor government office on the grounds of civilizational fitness. So the revolutionary surges diminished across the world.
Yet, as Albert Camus once remarked, the ultimate beneficiary of all modern revolutions has been the state. In Asia and Africa, one could add, the colonial state above all. Now, these books and some of my own work have concerned the intersections and mutual political and ideological appropriations of Euro-American events in Asia and the Middle East. But another historiographical result has been to re-emphasize the manner in which these Euro-American revolutions intersected with and mutually influenced a range of powerful endogenous movements within the extra-European world. I think that the concept of good conjuncture is critical as a tool for world history. Arabian Wahhabism, Indian Sikhism, and forms of Chinese millenarian Buddhism, which Jürgen has written about, were all political and ideological movements which shattered empires and kingdoms between 1700 and 1900. In many respects, these social eruptions also deserve the title of the revolution. I return to an issue of interpretation, and I think my BMW was very simplistic in this respect. It seems to me that at a broad level, all these events had the characteristics of revolutions. They were reactions by local polities and cults against the intrusive empires of the early modern world, and I'm sorry to use that phrase. These empires, like European maritime empires, had been powered by the expansion of world trade, silver flows, and gunpowder. Equally, like the French monarchy or the British in the 13 colonies, these polities founded on the problem of raising taxation to protect their power across huge land or sea spaces. These similarities resulted from actual connections in a flow of weapons, people, and silver, and not merely from world historians' comparisons. The ideological form of these movements also suggests significant analogies. The idea of disintermediation, removing the corrupt of the earth for Muslims or parasitic clergy, along with the ideal of a virtuous republic, whether of Cato and Brutus or of the prophet's day. Contemporaries even noticed the similarities. Napoleon sent emissaries to the Wahhabis in 1808, greeting them as brother revolutionary republicans fighting the corrupt empires of the Ottomans and the British. Ian Collar, an Australian scholar writing in Jane Rendell's volume, discovered this evocative piece in the Times of London. The Times, Monday, March the 31st, 1794. Constantinople. Among the higher classes here, the discontent is as great as amongst the mass of the people. It's occasioned by the Council of Twelve, who bestow all the posts and employments on their own creatures. The disturbances in Arabia have augmented the number of the followers of the sectary Reliab, deceased a century ago, who publicly announced their plan of overturning the Mohammedan religion. They threaten Mecca and Medina, and this appears to be a misunderstanding of the Wahhabi movement and the attack of Ibn Saud on those two cities. Now, contemporaries then clearly realized they were observing a conjunctural world history, even if they wouldn't have called it as such. So only perhaps in the most abstract realm of political theory does the comparison and connection between the Euro-American and the Islamic and Asian revolutions of the 18th and 19th centuries appear less convincing. And this, I think, is one of the issues about how far we should generalize, how far we should broaden world history. Here, Alan Ryan's discussion, "Was there liberalism in antiquity?" has been suggestive for my question, could there be revolutions within an Islamic, or for that matter, Sikh or Chinese or Buddhist tradition? Ultimately, Ryan answers the question negatively. Liberal toleration says, we don't really like your way of doing religion, but in the interest of social peace, we allow you as individuals the right to practice it. Antiquity, by contrast, didn't conceive religious pluralism as a dimension of individual rights, but as a question of different ethnicities performing their appropriate rites. By analogy, the Euro-American revolutions were represented, in political theory at least, as assertions by peoples of their collective rights, as gatherings of individuals bonded by history, language, and experience. By contrast, the emphasis in purist Islam was on the duties of believers to renew their submission to God and to purge innovation from the path of prophecy that had long since been laid out. Equally, when the rise of the Wahhabis raised the issue of toleration in the Ottoman Empire and beyond, it wasn't Locke's toleration based on the individual right to practice religion regardless of the stance of the state. The debate instead revolved around the nature of the majority in Islam and the cohesion of the community, with copious references to the debates of the Prophet's times. Now, this is an example, perhaps, of the way that we have to be wary of merging civilizational difference one into another. Of course, religion and traditionalist elements existed in the European tradition, as Isabella and Birgini have shown in their own versions of globalized Italian history. Mazzinian democratic nationalists and revolutionaries adopted the language of duties as well as those of rights, and also alluded to a transcendental deity moving in history. Again, some French and American patriots represented their revolutionary ideals as a return to the pious republic in the ancient tradition of Cato or Brutus. Yet the assertion of rights of the individual grouped in the collectivity, the people, does in fact mark out Euro-American revolutions at this level of abstraction. If the Muslim upsurges were indeed revolutions in the sense known to intellectual history, they were closer to Christopher Hill's Puritan revolution of the 17th century than to the ideals of Robespierre, though I doubt my old Oxford tutor would have agreed with this analysis. What I think we take from this whole range of examples is the idea that in addition to being a historian's sensibility, world history, global history, transnational history, transregional history, whatever we want to call it, is also a dialectical mode of thought. While seeking analogies, conjunctures, comparisons, or underlying structural connections, we should also be alert to difference, to the things that didn't move, that stayed put, or remained fundamentally local, even when they were thrust into a wider context. In the case of revolutions, what we can perhaps see is conjuncture without fusion. Here, I'm very much reminded of the way in which historical writing can swing quickly from one extreme to another. A generation back, particularly in Oxford, as I said earlier, British history, or rather English history, was a history of the deeply parochial, centering for this period on local preconditions for the Industrial Revolution and the Great Reform Bill. We were vaguely aware that some Marxists had suggested that primitive accumulation through imperialism had played a major part in the creation of capital for the revolution, but this was regarded as a bit of a joke. Even topics on the history of Asia, such as my Oxford special subject, Britain and India in the Age of Warren Hastings, turned out to concern factional politics at Westminster in the style of Sir Lewis Namier. Now, almost the opposite holds true. Several historians argue not only that empire created Britain, as Linda Colley has moderately argued, but that almost everything in 19th and early 20th century Britain was created by Britain's conquests and wars in the wider world. This seems to me to push world history to the point of self-destruction. There's no question that many of the key sciences of the 19th century, for instance, notably astronomy, were not simply sourced from global and imperial observations, but deeply affected by the imperial sensibility, as Simon Schaffer has brilliantly shown in his recent Tana lectures, and I wouldn't have been so effusive if I had known him he was in the room. Equally, there's no question that it was markets across the world, particularly in the empire, which sustained large parts of British industry through the long 19th century. But we must be careful. Firstly, as Schaffer himself argues, not everything moved, and certainly not globally. Some ideas, people, or economic systems were relatively immobile and inwardly directed. These were not always the obvious ones. Emma Rothschild observed that far from being untouched, part of La France profonde in the 18th century, the Massif Central was closely tied to the expansion of French trade and personnel into Canada and the Pacific. By a comparative leap, we can also assert that the apparently closed China of the Qing period, before the Opium War, was open to a far wider global connection than was once thought. Commodities, ideas, and people passed in and out of China, not only across the seas, but critically inland into the plains of Muslim Central Asia. By contrast, not all maritime Britain at all times was profoundly influenced by overseas trade and empire. Large parts of proto-industrial Britain's expansion, coal mining for instance, had little to do with the empire and the world, at least in the medium term. Even if we look at British or French history in a world context, we need to consider which fields of world history were most significant for national or regional histories at different periods of time. Brendan Sims, for instance, makes a good case that British foreign policy, and one could add its cultural gaze, was almost uniquely focused on Europe in the 18th century. Empire was much less significant than world historians have asserted. And there's some truth in this, I think, for the 19th century as well. So the global was not coterminous with empire, and empire in the British case was not simply the dependent non-white colonies in Asia and Africa. There's a good case to be made for the importance of Australia, Canada and New Zealand, white South African, and by extension, the United States, in the history of the British economy, gender, the welfare state, and literature throughout this whole period. As the Indian economic nationalist Dadabhai Nauroji pointed out, while drawing attention to India's poverty, Australia, with a tiny population of 4 million, bought annually 20 million of British goods in the 1880s, while India, with 150 million, brought a mere 25 million of British goods over the same period. For several decades now, imperial, now world history, especially in Cambridge, and I must admit full responsibility here, has not apparently stretched to the so-called white dominions. But for my parents and grandparents, they dwarfed Africa and India in importance as places of emigration and also icons pointing to a more liberal and less class-bound England. The reasons for this, I'm sorry to say, is that Australia and Canada, and to a lesser extent New Zealand, seemed boring to my generation, which was concerned with racial difference and the exotic. The fragmentation of imperial history into the history of small nationalities measuring the length of sheep fences didn't seem
stop digging.
Sorry, Chris.
I'll deal with you later.
What I've been arguing here is that world history needs to pay close attention through a dialectical methodology, first to what doesn't move in world context, relatively stable and resistant social and political and ideological structures. Secondly, we shouldn't misrecognize regional or global connections, influences and appropriations as a result of academic and political fashions. I now want briefly to continue with my theme of history, writing, teaching, historiography by example. I'll mention the work of two of our graduate students in world history. I could have mentioned almost everybody in the room, and then a project to which I myself have been involved. The first student is a mature, i.e. older, undergraduate, Adrian Leonard, who's somewhere over there, who spent some time in the city of London before bailing out happily before the world financial crisis. He has been using his expertise in the study of insurance of the China trade in the late 18th and 19th centuries, using the records of Jardine Matheson, which Jürgen, I'm sure, will know well. Insurance didn't figure much in Kane and Hopkins' huge studies of empire and globalization. But Adrian has shown how critical and widespread were insurance societies stretching from Philadelphia and London through Bombay, Calcutta, and Penang to the China coast. They draw on British, Indian, and indirectly Chinese capital. The worldwide expansion of services, in this case, the control of risk, was arguably a fundamental feature of the emerging world economy. As we know from Lehman Brothers, a butterfly flapping its wings in New York can cause a typhoon in the China seas. Related, and on the other side of the tracks, Simon Layton, who's somewhere over there, has been working on piracy as a discourse of control in a roughly similar period and a roughly similar area. The expansion of the discourse of piracy, he argues, from the Atlantic to the Indian Ocean and the China seas was itself an aspect of the normalization of imperial control later taken up by independent nation states. It's a significance as a world discourse and one intimately tied to global history writing and the global service industry is only too obvious today if we consider the case of the Somali pirates. These case studies, I think, show the potential of the study of individual historical issues to illustrate global themes. Not all world history needs to be done on a massive scale. What is required is a sensibility for the global, breaking away from closely bounded regional, economic, political, or intellectual histories. This takes me to my third and last case study, a study of the Indian and global appropriation of the great classical text, the Bhagavad Gita, Song of the Lord, part of the Sanskrit epic, the Mahabharata. This has resulted in a volume of the journal Modern Intellectual History, edited by our colleague Shruti Kapila and Faisal Devji at Oxford, to be published this summer. It's an attempt to push forward global intellectual history, in which India, or for that matter China, will play major parts, not simply as receptors. My own role in this has been to try to show how Western intellectuals used and cannibalized the text, as it became a kind of icon of India's growing civilizational importance in the later 19th century world. At one extreme, Christian apologists tried to show that the text was a bowdlerized form of the Bible. At the other extreme, theosophists used it to show the priority and scientific nature of Eastern religions. Romantic nationalists such as W.B. Yeats, gay Orientalists such as Edward Carpenter and E.M. Forster, contrarian philosophers such as Nietzsche and Aldous Huxley used it in various ways to attract Christian ethics. A liberal humanist and world statesman such as Sarvepalli Radhakrishnan, second president of India, used the Gita to argue for detachment and world peace in the 1940s. What we have then is a kind of global intellectual history, but one of appropriation and misrecognition, and this is the point I want to end with. All this seems to me to fit with what we know about the trajectory of other world religions and ideologies, from Buddhism in Islam to liberalism and Marxism, as they were cannibalized, misrecognized, and even deliberately distorted on their transit across the world. In other words, writing world history requires its practitioners constantly to bring themselves up sharp, to remind ourselves that global processes were often discontinuous, jagged, and they don't fit easily into straightforward connections or patterns. As Arjuna Padurai put it so well, the global and the local mutually cannibalize each other. World historians may be involved in an artillery duel, but they're also observers at the cannibal feast. Thank you.